Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Coming up on today's episode, another exit interview with another MP standing down at the next election. Today, former Minister Robin Walker. His dad was an MP. He discusses how that didn't really prepare him at all for doing the job, what it was like rebelling to get an EU referendum, then he backed Remain, then he became a Brexit minister for Theresa May, and was one of the first ministers to resign, forcing out Boris Johnson. He would have been even earlier, but there was a queue for the printer in the Commons Library. All that coming up in just a moment. Before that, the columnists. Today, Libby Purvis and Trevor Phillips on the wisdom of having a foreign secretary right now who once hailed a golden age for British relations with China. And why has Libby Purvis really upset some of the Scots? All that still to come. And if you like what you hear on the podcast, don't forget, you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits live on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. And it's a big, big morning here on Times Radio. Today we're going to give away £100,000. Yes, £100,000 giveaway. Oh, no, hang on, no we're not. No, we're not. No, we're not doing that. Jeremy Hunt thinks it's not a lot of money.
It doesn't go as far as you might think.
Oh, that's a shame. Well, we're not doing that then. Anyway, I hope you had a good weekend. The main thing I achieved in a week, I didn't achieve very much, I cut my hair. For those of you regular listeners know, I've been cutting my own hair now for 3 years.
I'm gonna wash that man right
yes.
Out of my
and on the
I'm
subject of hair, we have had so many messages about hair and shampoo. It's all Matthew Powers' fault. On the show last week, he mentioned that he doesn't use shampoo and hasn't done for 30 years. And lots of you had views on that. But by far and away, my favourite message we had was Edward, who got in touch and said, whilst at medical school, a doctor friend was told by one of the professors that detergents are all the same, echoing your comment about washing up liquid with a nice smell. I think that was someone else messaged that in. Edward goes on. The professor's recommendation was even cheaper than washing up liquid. Carpet shampoo. My friend bought a litre bottle and used it all over the following weeks. The result? His hair began to fall out. So please do not use carpet shampoo instead of actual shampoo. I can't believe that carpet shampoo is cheaper. Having once hired a carpet shampoo machine. Do not use carpet shampoo on your hair. Although if all the hair falls out, doesn't that mean that all your hair falls out of your carpet as well? I don't know. Get in touch in the usual ways. 0333 003 2353. Email Matt at times.radio.
The Columnists.
Yes, and this morning, on a Monday morning, we are joined by Libby Purvis. Hello, Libby.
Hello.
And Rachel Sylvester's on her holidays, which means we are joined by Trevor Phillips. Hello, Trevor.
Hi, Matt. Good to know that I've just been hauled off the bench for substitute for Rachel.
We just save you for special occasions, Trevor. That's what it is. And you've written for the Times today as well, so we'll talk about your column in a minute. First of all, let's talk about China and Britain's relationship with China. Deputy Prime Minister Oliver Dowden making a statement in Parliament today saying that Beijing is behind a wave of cyber attacks against MPs and peers, as well as accessing the personal details of 40 million voters in a hack on the Electoral Commission. And then later on Monday, David Cameron addressing Conservative MPs at a meeting of the Backbench 1922 Committee, where apparently he will again talk about the government's plans to counter Chinese cyber aggression. This is obviously coming after a time when he's been accused, the now Foreign Secretary, former Prime Minister, of being soft on Beijing. He was, of course, the Prime Minister who held a golden age of relations with China ahead of a visit by Xi Jinping in 2015.
This is going to be a very important moment for British-Chinese relations, which are in a very good state, something of a golden era in our relationship.
They're not in a very good state now, though, Libby.
No, it's fascinating, isn't it? Well, I think very few Western diplomats have really understood the two things about China, which is the ambitions of China and the vulnerabilities of China. And I think he was sort of, you know, stroking the vulnerabilities and sort of saying, you know, we're all friends, we need to be friends now. This is a golden age of good relationships. But behind that, there is the ambition. And it can be a very, very difficult country to understand. I mean, its history is so different from ours. I think, you know, we do need to have every kind of block against bots, you know, sort of cyber attacks and bots working on people's minds and attitudes, you know, all the way from, you know, sort of gigantic Lord Haw-Haw on everything from royal cancers to terrorism, which we know goes on. We need good defences against that. But at the same time, we need to carry on trying to understand what it is that China wants and needs from the rest of the world, because I think there is a vulnerability there as well.
There's also the question of what we want and need for them, isn't there, Trevor? They're, you know, nuclear power stations don't get built, gigafactory factories don't get built these days without Chinese investment.
Yeah, I think Libby's right, though, that we have to, in a way, get a better understanding of China. And the thing I would add is that we need to grasp that if you look at China's history and its attitude towards what you might call the outside world, and John Darwin, the Oxford professor of empires, written very brilliantly about this. China doesn't really care very much about the outside world. It is a world into itself, and its main concern has been to make sure that the rest of the world leaves it alone, even if that means, for example, buying up most of Africa and Latin America and buying a lot of our companies. I don't think we need to be worried too much about the idea that, you know, China's coming over the hill. It wants to colonize everybody. It doesn't want to do that. But what it wants to do is to make sure that we don't interfere with it. And it will do everything to make sure that that's the case. So I think this whole issue now, from the Chinese point of view, let me put it this way. We have always underestimated their capacity for ruthlessness. And I think maybe we're just beginning to realize that the rules that we play by about, you know, being reasonable and cooperation and all the rest of it are meaningless in Beijing.
And I suppose that's the thing. I mean, I spoke to Richard Walker, Conservative MP, who chairs the all-party group on China. I mean, he used a phrase that, you know, that they were trying to... They were there last week and trying to sort of say, look, if you don't want to be popular with the West, this is what you need to do if you want to be perceived as being likable. And I wasn't just totally clear, Libby, that is what China wants to do. I'm not sure they're worried about whether or not the all-party parliamentary group likes them.
Yeah, so it would be nice to think that they do mind. I think what is fascinating, what I think about this in the context also of Islamism, I think in the context of Russia, we sometimes need to sit back and think, what is it about Westernness, about, you know, the Western European and American model of society? What is it that freaks them out? You know, what is it? Is it a disorderliness? Is it this sort of the individualism? You know, what are the things which bother them about our cultures? And then try to understand, you know, why it is that these feelings occur. And as I say, it isn't just China. You know, it's also Russia. It's also I think Russia rather less in a way, because a lot of Russians like the idea of Westernness. But Islamism is part of that. We need to try and understand what it is about us which is found so both threatening and disgusting. You know, sort of chaotic and yet at the same time bossy.
Well, a bit of it is history, though, isn't it, Libby? I mean, from their point of view, and the there I'm talking about here are the groups that you regions you've just mentioned, the Asia, Middle East, and Islamic countries, and so on. We spent many centuries meddling in their affairs, and I suspect the main thing that they're bothered about is to get us out of their affairs. Now, I think it's perfectly reasonable for us to say, you know, we've got a right to say that our way of life is democratic, liberal, and so on, is better than what's there right now. And there's no reason why we shouldn't, for example, be able to show that to young Iranians who, as far as one can make out, would prefer our way of life. But I suspect what's driving many of these regimes is not some mystery. It's that they think what they want to do is better, and they want us to stop offering an alternative.
Absolutely, that we are seen as a wrong kind of society, and yet at the same time bossy. I mean, I think the idea of you know we have bossed the world, and we are rather reaping the whirlwind for that.
And do you think that David Cameron needs to sort of address this head on? Do you think he needs to sort of do a mea culpa? Does he sort of try to pretend this is all?
I think
part
he's still
of
a
what...
boss.
But for him, you know, for the literal, it's not just, you know, he was a part of the government. He was the prime minister who said it's a golden era of relations. And now he's the foreign secretary who's signing off sanctions.
Look, I mean, if all of us had to go back and trawl over everything that we had said 10 years ago.
But he's the foreign secretary, he's not a columnist, Trevor.
Yeah, but, you know, it's for everybody, and also the world changes. The world changes. You know, I could make a perfectly reasonable argument that says that actually, the prospects 10 years ago were completely different, than they are post COVID and so on and so forth. So I do think it's quite fun for us to tease public figures with what they said in the past. But do I think he should apologise? I don't think that's top of the agenda, really.
We'll see what happens, because I suspect this is a story which is going to run and run. Trevor, let's turn to your column today. And looking at the relationship, you know, looking at migrants, but also the workforce and how we get enough people into work. And Labour said it will keep its ban on zero-hours jobs and improvements to workers' rights after Peter Mandelson warned at the weekend against rushing through changes championed by trade unions. So there's this tension there. On the one hand, Labour says it's on the side of the workers, but then businesses worry about the amount of regulation and the impact that might have. Rachel Reeves, Shadow Chancellor, said in her lecture last week she wanted the Labour Party to work with business as we deliver and implement these policies. But then the Labour Party chair, Annalise Dodds, said the party was still committed to the package when she spoke to Times Radio yesterday.
No, we've not seen an improvement in labour market conditions over the last 14 years. We've been falling behind, and we need to make sure that we're actually at pace with the modern economy. That does mean making sure that we've got those measures which are good for workers, but they're very, very good for business as well.
There's a real tension there, isn't there, Trevor? When particularly if you're simultaneously trying to appeal to the workers who are going to vote, but the business leaders who might give you some money in the run-up to an election, and you need them to deliver the growth that you want afterwards.
Yeah, there is a bit of a problem. I mean, they are saying, Labour saying, we are pro-worker, we're also pro-business. And that's perfectly reasonable in most of the things they have to deal with. But some things, you can't be both. You've got to decide where you are. And on this 0 hours thing, it still isn't entirely clear to me. I mean, Rachel Reeves said a couple of weeks ago on television, we will ban 0 hours contracts. And then in her lecture last week, she said, we will ban exploitative 0 hour contracts. Well, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, isn't it? I mean, which contracts are exploitative and which aren't? Which employer is going to say, ah, yes, we realise that we have a contract which is exploitative. We're going to get rid of it. It's not going to happen. I think they're still a bit fuzzy about this. I think the main burden of my piece today, for which I think I'm probably going to get a massive kicking from my readers, is that we all ought to stop whining about the problems of immigration, because the truth of the matter is we just don't have enough people. You only need to look at the example of Japan, where, you know, for several decades the Japanese said, not going to have immigration, we're going to make robots do the work and all the rest of it. The Japanese economy has now stagnated for the best part of a quarter of a century, and they are finally coming around to the fact that they've got to let a few Koreans into the country, because they are the oldest developed society in the world. There are too many people there are too few workers and too many people dependent on those few workers. We don't want to get ourselves into that situation. So we're just basically going to suck it. Whatever you think about immigration, the reality is we're going to have to suck it up and deal with the consequences. And I guess my piece today is really that as we run up to the next election, Tories obviously want to make this a big deal. And my point is just everybody get real. Deal with the actual situation we're in rather than the one that everybody would like to pretend that we're in.
And there's such a sort of doublespeak, isn't there, Trevor, between they make such a fuss about the number of people coming here illegally. And obviously, you know, there's a big problem with the fact that it's very, very dangerous to be doing that in small boats. But the number of people coming into the UK legally, because the government recognises that they need them to fill the jobs and to generate anything approaching GDP, you know, that has gone up massively. That's up far, far, far more than the illegal migration. But they sort of try to wrap them all up into one to try and hide the fact that that's what they're based on.
100%. They're soaking up parliamentary time. They're soaking up attention, media attention. They're soaking up money on the whole round of thing, where actually what they've done, I think, in the last year is probably turned back maybe 10, 15,000. Well, the net migration figures legally last year were knocking on 750,000. Now, if you really want to do something about the thing that people care about, because not that many people, frankly, are affected by people coming across and landing at Dover on small boats. What most people are thinking about when they think about migration is, have we got enough houses in our local area? Will my son or daughter get a job, or will that go to a clever Slovakian or Indian or Nigerian? Will the wages be depressed and so on? Now, government's got to decide what it wants to do. And to be absolutely frank, in spite of all the rhetoric, all of the talking about, you know, we're going to get it down below 100,000 and so on and so forth, in the budget, Jeremy Hunt relied on the Office for Budget Responsibility forecasts, which depend on a rolling average of about 350,000 net migration every year for the next 5 years, and it will be bigger beyond that. And I'm simply saying, why not just be honest in what you say and match it with what you do? Because the truth of the matter is, everybody in the country knows that this pretense that you're going to get the numbers down is just nonsense. And the consequence is people stop trusting what politicians are saying. We're seeing the numbers, the trust numbers down into single figures. 9% of people say that they trust politicians to tell the truth. And this is the reason.
That's really interesting. What do you make of it, Libby?
I thought it was fascinating. I was very struck by Peter Mandelson trying to explain that he was pro-business and yet pro-worker, and absolutely not grasping the problem that was caused not just by the last 14 years of Conservative government, but by New Labour's passion for business investors, and ignoring of an awful lot about ordinary lives and ordinary needs like housing and public services and pools and decent parks and so on. The things which make life okay for people were ignored by two lots of governments in favour of sucking up to business and talking growth, growth, growth. Oh, this is wonderful. With no pushback against foreign ownership, no pushback against globalism. And I think that really matters. I think when you're talking about elections, and we always are on this programme, people's ordinary lives are what counts, and if they see their area degraded, they may end up blaming it on migration, unfairly blaming it on migration, yeah. But there are other things to blame it on.
It was a fascinating column, and I suspect you might well be getting some angry reaction to it, Trevor, but it's okay. You're in good company, because Libby's getting lots of angry reaction to her column as well. She's upset the
Maybe
Scots.
Maybe from Scotland, I would think.
Libby, why don't you explain, first of all, how you've upset most of Scotland?
I didn't want to write this piece at Easter. I want to write about fluffy kittens and rabbits and things. But I've been trying not to write this for quite a long time. I grew up, because I had a lowland Scottish father, with very much a moral image of Scotland. And it was actually, you know, it was sort of buttressed by visits there and knowing people there. It's all about plain speaking and proper pride and trustworthiness and freedom, a seriousness about education, hard work and value for money and all that stuff. You know, that atmosphere of Scottishness. And you watch the SNP and what the SNP has done and failed to achieve in Scotland, you know, the problems of education, the problems of health service, the endless grandstanding, the obsession with independence rather than carrying out the kind of proper administration that the country needs. And now we kind of move towards this extraordinary, and the ferries, I mean, the list is so great. And a lot of people, I have to say, underline this morning, are not upset by it at all. They agree, even from Scotland. But this sort of miserable degradation, this poor administration of the SNP for these 17 years, and the sort of edges of supposed corruption around it still being investigated. And then you look at this appalling, illiberal, mad variation on hate crime laws with third-party reporting centres and this great list of categories not to be insulted, which of course doesn't include women. You can insult women all you like. And the announcement, you know, the police thing that the likely perpetrators of this crime are young men with deep-rooted feelings of being socially and economically disadvantaged. In other words, young men who are victims of a very poorly run society. And I just find it upsetting to think about Scotland, because I love Scotland and Scottish heritage and the traditional way of being Scottish, and the SNP seems to me to have degraded it. And so I wrote this and just retired behind the sofa for people to throw things at me. It's just how it felt.
Well, Mary's been in touch saying, tell Libby most of we sensible Scots completely agree with her. I'm currently embarrassed to be Scottish, says May. My favourite of all, because I look at some of the comments under your column, Libby, and lots of them are supportive. One says, from Phil Davison, what a sad, pathetic attempt at journalism by someone I've never heard of. And I've been a journalist for 55 years. Anyway, you can't be very good if you haven't heard of Libby Purvis.
55 years. I've never heard of him either, but I shall find out.
No, exactly.
Out now.
I've definitely never heard of him as well. 55 years, he didn't once put the Today programme on. Extraordinary. Trevor, what did you make of it? Do you want to upset the Scots? I suppose, I'm making a mistake here. I'm conflating two things, which is what they like to do. There is a difference between the Scots and the SNP.
And the SNP, yeah.
Indeed, yeah. Look, first of all, beautiful, beautiful piece. I mean, I just think it's part of a columnist's duty to do certain things. And in this one where Libby calls attention to, I love this phrase, the practical, understated Caledonian virtue. I think Libby is calling up a Scotland, which actually I knew quite well as a child, because one or two of my best friends are from there and I spent a lot of time in Islay. And it's gone. And I think what she has said about the SNP's behaviour, which is in a way to have a sort of faux righteousness, which somehow pretends to be embody those old Scottish values of Presbyterian understatedness and so on, but actually is really quite shockingly self-centred and just about the words rather than the doing things. I think Libby's got it right, and it's in a way sad to see this happening in such a wonderful nation.
Libby Purvis and Trevor Phillips, and of course you can read them in The Times every week with your subscription. Just go to thetimes.co.uk. Up next is the exit interview of Robin Walker.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
The big thing.
We've already said.
Robin Caspar Walker is leaving us soon.
Goodbye.
Born in 1978, he's been the Conservative MP for Worcester since 2010, holding a number of ministerial jobs. In his exit interview, he tells me how having a father who is an MP didn't prepare him for life in Parliament.
I probably underestimated my level of ignorance.
While it was so difficult being a Brexit minister in Theresa May's government.
Going into one room and dealing with people with one view, going to another room and dealing with people with a diametrically opposed view.
And he delivers his verdict on his former bosses, including David Cameron.
Too sure of himself when it came to referendums.
And Liz Truss.
Not in my view someone with the breadth of support or ambition.
And the surreal moment he became the fourth person to resign from Boris Johnson's government and found others queuing to do the same.
I would have been the third if the printers had been working properly in the library.
So, Robin Walker, thank you for joining me for your exit interview. A chance for us both to learn what you could have done better. First question, why are you leaving?
For me, it's mainly about family. It's mainly about wanting to be in one place. And yeah, you know, I've had an amazing time over the last 14 years. A lot has happened. I've been able to be a minister, a select committee chair and a backbencher. And I've loved each of those for the opportunities that they brought. But I felt that with young children, I wanted to be able to stay in one place and not be either leaving them during the week to be in Westminster or vice versa, you know, leaving them to go for constituency, be campaigning every weekend. So for me, it was a very personal decision. It was one which is about making sure that my family could all stay together all of the time. And I remember well my father's advice about going into politics, which was to make an absolute fortune before you do it, which rings more true to me now at the end of the thing than perhaps it did when I was a young, free and single man in my 20s trying to get into politics.
So let's deal with those two things. We'll do your children, then we'll do your father afterwards. It's interesting you say that because this has come up quite a lot, actually, doing this series. You know, you became an MP in 2010. Even at that point, there was talk about making it more family-friendly and changing the hours and blah, blah, blah. Is it just impossible, actually, to have anything resembling a family life while you're working, essentially, offered in two different ends of the country?
It's definitely challenging. And I think, you know, some families manage to do it brilliantly. They're incredibly supportive. They manage to move backwards and forwards or they manage to anchor themselves in one place. For me, you know, I always wanted to be able to see my children every day. And that means that you've either got to spend a lot of time with them in the car driving backwards and forwards to a constituency, or you've got to arrange things so that you can come back and be in one place. And there's no perfect solution. For some colleagues I know, their families stay in the constituency and they're away from them 3 days of the week, but then they're back with them over the weekend. For others, the family are based more in London, and then you have the advantage of being able to see them on early weekday mornings, which is more the approach we've taken. When I was a child, yeah, we did travel backwards and forwards for constituency, but that was going up on a Friday afternoon and coming back on a Sunday. And I remember very well having the sudden realization, age about 13, that a weekend was supposed to consist of two whole days, because I'd always assumed that it was only Saturday and Sunday morning.
And so let's talk about that then, because I think you're the first person who's done an exit interview who had a parent who was also an MP. Your dad, Peter Walker, fought nine elections between 1961 and 1992. So what was that like growing up, like you said, with an MP in the household? And my impression would be that it would put you off the idea of a career in politics rather than draw you closer to it.
I think that's probably right in most circumstances. And I'm one of five children, and none of the other four went into politics. I think I was just the right age not to be put off, actually. I was 14 when my father retired from frontline politics. I still found it all quite exciting and quite lively. I used to like to go along to meetings and see what was happening and that side of things. Maybe I hadn't seen some of the downsides and some of the challenges in the way that perhaps my older siblings had. Yeah, it's about different types of personality. And I think that is something that, you know, I've always been attracted to the campaigning side, the doorstep side of politics. I've always found that really exciting. But I know some of my siblings wouldn't touch it with a barge pole.
And given that you were young growing up, you'd probably thought, I know a bit more about what all this politics involves than lots of people. How did your experience then coming in 2010, did it match or not match your expectations?
It's a really good question. To be honest, I probably underestimated my level of ignorance. I think a lot of colleagues assumed when we all arrived together in 2010 that because I came from a political family, I came pre-programmed with a huge knowledge of how everything worked. And I really didn't. I found it an enormous learning curve. But bearing in mind where we were at the time with the whole expenses scandal and so on and so forth, I've naively been looking at this. And in the run-up to having won the election, the run-up to actually turning up to Parliament, I had in my mind, I'm going to be able to do this all by myself. I'm going to answer all my emails. I'm going to answer all my letters. I don't understand why MPs need staff. All this kind of stuff that you'd expect a complete outsider to assume. And then on day one, you know, I got hit by this avalanche of letters, emails, a parcel, you know, 2 foot tall, which was left over from my predecessor of letters that needed to be answered, which had come in during the election campaign. And I had a rude awakening to the life of a modern MP. And it took me some time to organize the office to get the right people working with me to make sure that that could be handled. And I think that was very different between my time and my father's, actually, because, you know, whilst the letters were there, undoubtedly, and he had brilliant team who supported him and helped to answer the letters, of course, in the meantime, email had come along. Electronic communication had made it so much easier for people to get hold of their MPs. And in many ways, that's a good thing. But it certainly does mean that the need to be constantly responsive has stepped up by a degree, I would say, probably of about 10 times since that period, early 90s, when he left government and when I came into Parliament in 2010.
So let's talk then what happened when you came in 2010. The following year, you were one of 81 Tories who rebelled against David Cameron, calling for a referendum on EU membership. Did you think then, in 2011, you were pulling the lever on something that was going to fundamentally change Britain as we know it and put us where we are right now?
I think the honest answer has to be no. I did think it was something fundamentally important. I thought there was a need for people to have a genuine say, and I hadn't made up my mind at the stage where I was rebelling for a referendum as to which side of a referendum I would campaign on. I did eventually make up my mind to campaign for Remain, very much on the basis of what I thought were the interests of my constituency at the time and what I felt was the right thing in terms of having an easier economic road to travel if we stayed in. But I always fundamentally accepted that it had to be a proper decision for the British people. And that's why on day one after the referendum, I said, you know, everyone's got to come together and try and make this work now. We've got to find a way of making that happen. And, you know, I didn't necessarily expect that to translate to Ben becoming a Brexit minister, but it did. And that was then an incredible opportunity to work on something really important. It was unbelievably difficult. It was, as we all know, very, very contentious. And there were all sorts of fallings out along the way. But one of the things that actually I'm proudest of is the way in which lots of people who campaigned on different sides of the referendum came together to actually deliver on the outcome. And that we did eventually deliver on that in a way that didn't realise the worst fears of all the people who had campaigned to Remain. And I think that was always, I felt a responsibility to try and do that as someone who'd supported a referendum and as someone who saw the intellectual justification for why we had to have a referendum. And that goes way back. I mean, I remember arguing with my father about this when he was very pro-EU. And I wrote essays for my A-level politics arguing why there had to be a referendum because neither of the main parties were giving people a real choice. So this is something that was quite deep-rooted and I felt quite strongly about, even though, as I say, I think the question of which side to be on during the referendum debate was a slightly separate one from whether or not we had to have one.
Given what we know now and how the last, 8 years have panned out since the referendum, do you think you were still right? Your concerns about the impact on your constituents, the uncertainty, the untangling and all that, were you right to have backed Remain?
I was right on some of the issues. I mean, I think at the time, I remember talking a lot about the challenges for Northern Ireland. And I think that has been borne out, unfortunately. It's been longer and more difficult to resolve some of those challenges than I think many people on the Leave side expected. But I think probably we were wrong on the big economic argument. And I think we've seen that. And I think we've seen, you know, the UK has actually been one of the more dynamic economies in Europe, albeit in hugely challenging circumstances. We've seen economic growth and we've seen strong trade figures in a way that many people on the Remain side didn't believe would be possible if we left. I mean, I also think that the way in which the Remain campaign talked up the fears was counterproductive. And I think it switched many voters in the last few weeks of that campaign to saying, you know, you're just being over the top here and we don't believe you and therefore we're going to vote Leave. There's an interesting post-mortem to be done on that. But fundamentally, this was always a democratic process. 55% of my constituents voted to leave. You have to deliver on that. And that's what I felt myself bound to do.
You mentioned that you were a minister in the Brexit department for 3 years under Theresa May. You were a junior minister in Scotland, then Northern Ireland, Minister of State for Schools. You're now chair of the Education Select Committee. And you've been on and off select committees sort of in between. Where do you think you can, as an individual politician, have the most impact? Is it climbing the lower rungs of the ministerial ladder? Is it as a backbencher causing trouble in rebelling? Is it as a select committee chair? When you come to stand down whenever the election is, which is the bit where you think, that was when I really was sort of in the groove and I was changing something?
It's a really interesting question because there are different things you can do in each of those roles. I think, you know, in many ways, being a junior minister can feel very constraining in that you're very much stuck to being able to speak on your brief. You're very much stuck to being able to speak in your policy area. And of course, you don't have the freedom just to make decisions that you might personally like. You have to be able to do it based on advice and within the constraints of Treasury spending priorities and the departmental priorities. But equally, you can still get stuff done behind the scenes. You can make the case for things in your constituency. You can write to colleagues about issues you feel strongly about. So it doesn't stop you from doing that work, but it does make that work significantly less visible. I think being a select committee chair, to me, is a really exciting thing to be able to have that balance of doing things where you're using evidence to make a case for something. You're working with people from all sides of the house and from all different backgrounds to make an evidence-based case for change. You get a hearing because you have that sort of seat of being a select committee chair. And you get very well informed. But to be honest, some of the work of which I'm proudest is work that I did as a backbencher without any of those titles and, you know, jobs and, you know, accolades. And actually, you know, things like the campaign I led with a few others on the Conservative benches to make sure that there was Conservative support for putting a cap on high cost lenders and people like Wonga, who at the time were really ripping off a lot of consumers. That's probably one of my proudest things I did in Parliament. And that was just as an ordinary backbencher. Things like that can make a big difference to a lot of people. But of course, the other part of it is, and the part of it I think all of us spend much more time out of the public eye doing than most of the public would ever realise, is the constituency casework, the day-to-day stuff you can do for constituents. And for me, that's just as important, not nearly as prominent, but probably makes a bigger difference to the people you help than almost anything else an MP can do.
I wonder, because actually doing this series, what's been striking is people talk about the times when they felt like they made a change and had an impact and had an effect. Actually, this does not feel like a government which is absolutely firing on all cylinders, changing the world right now. I wonder if your part of your decision for standing now, Dan, now is you don't want to stick around for the warfare that will almost certainly follow if there is a Conservative defeat in the next election. It's going to be old time, isn't it?
I've never been particularly interested or excited by faction fighting. That's certainly true. But actually, you know, I don't think anything's inevitable in politics. I do think, you know, we saw it with 22 the other day, colleagues coming together from all sides of the party and saying, actually, we've got to make sure that we put our best foot forward and campaign for a prime minister who is the right man to be leading the country forward. I hope that they are able to continue to do that because that's what I want to see. Actually, part of my thinking about making my announcement when I did is that for the first time in a while, I was comfortable about who was leading our party. And I didn't feel I had to stay around to fight to see the change I wanted. You know, having obviously resigned from Boris Johnson's government, he had many brilliant qualities. but I think he hadn't, by the end of things, shown that he was the right man to be prime minister. Having gone through the period, the slightly bizarre period, I'd say, in which we had this trust leading the party, it wasn't one I was deeply comfortable with, but it was one I recognised the members had chosen. I didn't, you know, cause trouble during that period. But having gone through that period, I then felt actually we had someone in charge of the party who I could comfortably feel was the right person to lead the party forward. And part of my reasoning in being able to then say, actually, now is quite a good time to step back, is that I felt that my association would have time to choose a really good candidate, which they'd done. And they would be able to take things forward in calmer waters. I hope we can focus on that. And I hope that we can also focus on a lot of the very good things in our record. But I think we do have to point to, because I think sometimes the lack of unity in the pages of the newspapers distracts from that.
Robin, you've had a lot of leaders in that time. So let's work our way through them then. Sum them up in a word for us in your exit interview. Can you sum up David Cameron in a word?
Fresh, probably when he started, and then maybe too sure of himself when it came to referendums.
Very good. Theresa May, then. She came in to clear up that mess. Theresa May, in a word?
Hardworking and dutiful, two words.
Did you, when you look back on that period when you were one of her Brexit ministers, from the outside, it can feel a bit like those 3 years, an awful lot happened and yet actually nothing happened. We voted to leave as a country in 2016. We didn't leave. And then in 2019, Boris Johnson came along and sorted it out. Is that a fair reflection of the wading through treacle that was 2016 to 2019?
Inevitably not. I mean, I think she always wanted to deliver that balance between delivering on the aspirations of people who wanted to leave, really leaving the European Union, and recognising and addressing the fears of people who voted to remain. And I think that was a very worthy aspiration. I think the challenge is that she was not able to maintain the coalition of the support within the party in order to deliver that. And so I think from the inside, it was very frustrating because we were constantly working towards a goal that we knew we wanted to achieve of leaving with a deal. But the political balance that needed to be achieved in order to deliver that through Parliament kept changing. I remember sitting there on the third meaningful vote when she was launching this and looking at the faces of the people in the audience, looking at the launch and just thinking, this is not going to work out well. Doing everything I could to support the approach that was being taken, but knowing really that there was not a political way through at that time. And to his credit, Boris did unblock that.
So we go then, if Theresa May was hardworking and dutiful, how would you sum up Boris Johnson?
Brilliant and mercurial, perhaps, would be a good...
Brilliant and mercurial. Were you surprised that when you joined his government that you then found yourself resigning, not over some huge policy disagreement, but essentially a more personal disagreement about the way he was behaving in office?
Yes. And to be honest, until the day before I resigned, it was not something that I was thinking about, you know, I will be resigned. It was one of those sleepless nights where I genuinely had a long, hard think about where things were and felt I had to come in and resign. I mean, I think I don't know quite where I come in the official rankings. I think I was the fourth or fifth minister to resign in that sequence. I would have been the third if the printers had been working properly in the library. And so I think it was something that, contrary to certain rumours and sort of books that have been written about this, there was no pre-coordination about the fact. And I genuinely, when I was writing my resignation letter, I expected that I might be the third and only person to be resigning the day after Sajid and Rishi had gone. And so it was quite a surprise to me when I think by the end of the day, we had 55. That wasn't something that I had anticipated or expected in any way.
So was there a queue in the Commons Library to get to the printer?
Pretty much. It was a very surreal experience that day.
So he goes then to be replaced by Liz Truss. Sum up Liz Truss for us.
Determined, but not, in my view, someone with the breadth of support or ambition to be able to take our party forward. And I think the challenge that she ran into is that I think she was talking to quite a narrow group of people, and I don't think she was able to hold the parliamentary party together. I don't think there's much more to say than that. I mean, I remember that moment really when the whipping all fell to pieces, and it was an extraordinary moment, like nothing I've ever seen in Parliament really, where it just seemed that the communication between the centre and the whip's office had broken down completely.
I would urge you to launch an investigation into the scenes outside the entrance to the No Lobby earlier.
There has been
an element of confusion over whether the vote was a confidence vote or not.
I think it's a shambles and a disgrace. I think it is utterly appalling. I really shouldn't say this, but I hope all those people that put Liz Truss in number 10, I hope it was worth it.
And at that moment, I thought this isn't going to last. And sure enough, it didn't.
What's gone wrong in the... Because you've been around the Conservative Party, man and boy, in one sort of another. What's gone wrong in the Conservative Party that its membership went for the person who... And this has come up time and time again in doing these interviews. To the people who knew her best, her colleagues in Parliament, was so ill-suited to the job. She couldn't... She didn't win a majority amongst MPs going into that race. What's gone wrong with the Conservative Party that the membership... who, you know, went for David Cameron, actually went for Boris Johnson. But, you know, they used to be the fine, upstanding, sensible people, the quiet, calm Conservatives, and instead blew everything up with Liz Truss. What's gone wrong inside the Conservative Party that meant that could happen?
I don't blame members for what happened. I mean, I think what happened over a period of time is that you had the grassroots, the people who feel very strongly about Conservative policies, feeling that the business of government didn't necessarily result in the outcomes that they wanted to see. And I think that's, to some extent, that's going to happen to any party that's in office over a long period of time. It certainly happened to the Conservative Party during the period of Margaret Thatcher and John Major. You know, there's a certain amount of, I think, wanting, quote unquote, their party back, and therefore wanting to go for someone who sounded in tone much more conservative and much more strident. I think many of my councillors, many of my activists, members of the party in Worcester were very concerned about that because they recognise in a place like Worcester, you're constantly having conversations with people who come from a different political tradition. In order to win people, we couldn't just afford to appeal only to the grassroots and only to Conservative supporters. But I think there was a certain element as well of people, you know, wanting to put a marker down, wanting to have their say. You know, I had those conversations with my membership. There were a range of different views amongst my members. And you have to respect the process of a vote by members, which is why, by the way, during that whole period of the Liz Truss government, I wasn't speaking out and trying to make life difficult for them. I had actually done on the fracking vote exactly what I was asked to do, which was to go in and speak on the issue and say I wanted things to change, but not cause trouble with my voting. And then when that whipping fell apart, that just felt deeply painful, especially to those of us who had strong views about it, but had reined them in order to support the party leader.
So then she goes, and along comes Rishi Sunak. So sum up Rishi Sunak in a word for us.
I think competent, ambitious would be two words that spring to mind. He's taken on the challenge at a hugely difficult time, but I think what he did during furlough was absolutely phenomenal. And actually, I think a lot of his priorities very much align with some of my own thinking, some of my own views. So I'm very comfortable with this man. I think he's the right person to be taking us forward. I think that perhaps unfairly, partly because of his time at the Treasury, partly because of his background in business, I think he has a challenge sometimes communicating that to the wider public. And I think that's where he's got a job to do. But actually, he's got a really strong record to talk about in that respect on being on people's side. And that's something that I would hope comes out more.
Let's just round off with some classic exit interview questions. You've talked about your proudest moments in the job. What's been the bit of the job you've enjoyed the least?
I think there's two things. One was dealing with the various sort of factions and pressures during the Brexit process over a long period of time did become very wearing, going into one room and dealing with people with one view and going into another room and dealing with people with diametrically opposed view was very challenging. And perhaps on a similar note, one of the most difficult, but I think worthwhile and important things I had to do was carrying through the EF Act legislation in Northern Ireland to introduce same-sex marriage and abortion. And that was incredibly difficult, a huge opposition, very strong feelings and deeply held feelings locally. It was very uncomfortable and very, very difficult at the time. But I think it was one of those things which was worthwhile taking that pain in order to get it done.
Did you ever have private conversations with politicians in Northern Ireland who actually were quite pleased it was you doing that difficult work? Stormont wasn't sitting and they could just slightly turn a blind eye and let, you know, it was a good thing that this was probably happening, but they weren't going to have to be the ones to do the dirty work?
I think there was a feeling, but there were certainly some people in Northern Ireland who were glad they didn't have to address this issue. And I mean, I do think it's right that issues of that nature generally should not be whipped. They should not be pushed through by governments. They should be done on a free vote and for members of parliament. Of course, the huge frustration in Northern Ireland at the time is, as we've seen too often in Northern Ireland, the locally elected members weren't able to have their say because the institutions weren't functioning. And it's great that they are functioning again. From the reports I hear, they're functioning quite well and there's some really good working. But one of the issues I think Northern Irish politicians need to bear in mind is that they need to show constantly to a sceptical constituency that actually the institutions do work and can resolve not just the easy issues, but the difficult issues as well.
Now, this is a question we've asked everyone. Would you recommend the job? And bearing in mind, you know, normally I say to a friend or someone you care about, but would you recommend it to your children to continue the Walker dynasty? Is politics a thing that you'd recommend to someone you cared about?
Yes, but with the understanding that it is incredibly challenging. I always say when I speak in schools about politics, it is extraordinarily worthwhile. It can be incredibly rewarding, but it will always also be incredibly challenging and frustrating. And there are some things that you campaign on for years and years and you don't move the dial. And so one of the things you have to grow accustomed to, I think, in politics is to a degree of disappointment that you can make the most brilliant speech in the world about something and actually nothing changes as a result. But equally, when you do move the dial, and usually with the help of a lot of other people, it's incredibly worthwhile and valuable. And that's something that I think, you know, whether it's select committee work, whether it's work in government, whether it's work on the back benches, you can make a real difference. And that's why I'd recommend it. But I'd say to people, go in with your eyes open. It's never easy. It is always a big challenge to get a sensible work-life balance, and making sure that you can fit family around it and manage family well with it is a big challenge. And there are probably procedural things we could do to improve that. But at the end of the day, it is it's such an important job, but it's quite right that most of the time it comes first.
Finally then, for last question, your exit interview, Conservative MP Robin Walker, what will you do next?
That's a very good question. And I keep telling my wife that, yeah, I'd love to spend more time at home and write poetry. She seems to think I need to go out and make a living. So I suspect it is something that I shall be making sure I do the latter. But I haven't worked out the specific next step. Whatever those opportunities are, I will certainly keep an interest in and follow politics closely.
Well, Robin Walker, we really appreciate you joining us for your exit interview. Conservative MP for Worcester, thanks for joining us on Times Radio. I don't want to see you go, but darling, you better go now. So that's another exit interview done. If you want to revisit any of the more than a dozen we've done so far, just search for the exit interviews wherever you're listening to this. But for now, for me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.